Me, I think the foundation of leadership, it comes in the reflection of yourself. If you don't understand who you are or why you behave in particular ways or the things that inspire you or trigger you or challenge you, then I think you always will struggle to be a leader because you have blind spots about what impact you put on the people that you're supposed to be leading. And you don't understand why you're strong or why you're good at what it is that you do.
Hey everyone, this is Ben Morton. It's great to be talking to you again, and thank you for joining me for episode 26 of the podcast. In this episode, I'm joined by the inspirational community leader and businessman, Marvin Harrison. Marvin's leadership experience as the founder and driving force behind Dope Black CIC, an educational and healing platform designed to improve the outcomes of Black people, has seen him become the voice of the Black community across the UK, US, and African continent. Marvin is also the co-founder and VP of Strategy, Marketing, and Sales of Beloved Agency, a DEI consultancy working for the advancement of all intersections of humanity in the workplace and our places of education. Through his work with Beloved, Marvin is able, in his own words, to dedicate his future to supporting businesses and organisations in their evolution to becoming more representative of the diverse cities they operate in and the dynamic consumers that they serve. I think this is a fascinating and enlightening episode that touches on some areas that we've not explored in previous episodes of the show. It was fascinating to hear Marvin talk about the similarities and differences of leading social enterprises or organizations in the charitable sector and those in the commercial profit-making sector. One of the most insightful sections of the interview for me was what Marvin shared around his own experience with therapy and emotional work, and his belief that this is something that all leaders would benefit from. So, folks, without any further delay, let's dive right in to my interview with Marvin Harrison. Marvin, hello, welcome to the podcast. How are you? And for people listening, whereabouts in the country or world are we talking to you from?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very well, thank you. Apart from the obvious lockdown, which we're all universally experiencing, there are many, many positives happening at the same time. So my optimism hat is on more than off. And I'm currently based in East London in the UK.
Amazing. So listeners to the show will be familiar with the very first question, which is always the backstory question, Marvin. So would you mind just telling us a little bit about your career journey, what you're doing at the moment? But as I said, when we was chatting just before I hit record, if you could stop right before the Dope Black Dads story, that would be amazing, because I'd love to ask you about that separately, because I think it's fascinating.
Sure. So it's interesting. My career was full of many chance occurrences and very much by accident. So when I left college, which is quite far back now, well, not too far, but I didn't really have a plan to go to university, actually. I didn't even know that no one in my family had gone before. There was no recruiter for universities at my college being like, have you thought about it? So I pretty much had planned to go straight and find a job pretty much in retail, to be completely honest, and then just figure out life from there. But actually, about a month before my college degree ended, or my college education finished, the facility that we were in basically said that we can't finish the year because all the teachers have left in your department and there's no one we can get in to finish off your school year. So the whole year is void. And so I had to go and reapply and redo my whole year again somewhere else. So I went to another place, and when I got there, they were a lot more intentional about going to university. And that really set me up by, when I walked into my, you know, the halls of my university, the open day, I originally was going to go and do accounting because I felt that was finance, and that's something that a skill everyone needs, and it would get me a job. And then the person that was doing accounting was very, very underwhelming. And the person who was doing marketing was this eccentric Canadian woman. Her name was Lynn Voss. She actually still speaks now. It's an incredible woman, and she was being extremely animated and passionate. And I stood by her. And at the end of it, I signed up to marketing. And so you know, I had no idea that my natural skill set was around marketing strategy, communications. I just thought it looked more interesting than what I was going to. And so my career as a result of sort of that shift is, you know, I finished university and I remember my very, very first job was I looked in the Evening Standard, which is a paper in London, and they have a job section. And the job section was a marketing manager may have been the role. And it was like 23,000 per year, which was, you know, more than my age at the time. And I thought that was a really important marker for success. And it was, you know, it was in this organization called the Institute of Nuclear Engineers. And I have no nuclear or energy or membership or institution experience at this point. I've just finished university. But the way I pitched I think he was the managing director, but the way I pitched him was so aggressive, clear, but like, when I say aggressive, I mean like professionally aggressive, as in I wanted it. And I had a very clear plan about what they could do, where the gaps were, the shifting into digital, what they're missing, and how I can add value. He probably just looked at me as a 23-year-old. So at the very, very least, his energy will get him somewhere. So my first job was marketing manager at this Institute of Nuclear Engineers. And I never forget the guy, Mark Askew, brilliant, kind, warm-hearted guy from Coventry, a wonderful guy. And he really allowed me freedom to like understand marketing in a working context and allowed me, you know, he gave us a budget and, you know, clear objectives, but he really, really helped me and supported me to give me the freedom to figure it out. So shortly after joining there, I had a few short-term stints as a contractor in like EMAP at the time. I was at News UK for 2 years, which was News International at the time, which is a fantastic baptism of fire. So I joined, obviously, and I was marketing manager, but there I was doing e-com, which is very early stages of e-com. This is maybe 2007-8. And at the time, they were pivoting from newspapers and how to monetize online. So it was about driving people from the editorial content in the newspaper to go online and buy. And then within that, there was revenue to be generated. There was partnerships with all the major retailers to drive them traffic from our site to convert on products that were featured. And so ultimately this platform was being launched and I was the one that was leading it. And there wasn't very much knowledge in the business. And so again, I pitched my way in and it really taught me about the commercial side of marketing and the more performance side of marketing, which I never really understood before. It was more about brand campaigns and looking good and telling stories and connecting. But this was really about, you know, if I put an ad in this paper on a Sunday in the News of the World, how much money is generated from this ad? Is that space better used to sell to advertisers or is it better served for, you know, our own internal products? And we was working on these metrics and I was building out this reporting platform. And that was a fantastic opportunity for me to really get my chops into it. And then shortly afterwards, after 2 years, there was the crash, I think it was 2007-8. And in that time, there was redundancies. And I went on to Betfair, which again was another fantastic business. And there it was about VIP marketing, sort of high value players in sports betting, and then providing communications, usually by CRM, about what new offers and keeping them engaged on the platform. And what I loved about there is that there was a lot more of a creative element. There was also a technical element of email marketing. So at this point, I've now done brand marketing with Institute of Nuclear Engineers. I've done e-com at News UK, and I've now done eCRM at Betfair. And I think I'm building this real, you know, useful skill set of how each function in marketing operates. And Betfair was a really great example. I went to the Ascot there. I went to some football games there. There was a great culture with some of the people there. And I had, you know, an amazing just under 2 years. And then after that, I took a break, actually. And I went and set up my own company. A lot of my friends were in the music business and had managed some of the best artists at the time, and the Retro Twos and the Ed Sheerans and the Tinchy Striders. And so I decided that I wanted to support their business models and help them with digital marketing and brand partnerships. So I did that for about 4 years. We did, you know, things with Bacardi and Barclaycard and Wireless Festival and some stuff internationally as well with New York and Hot 97. So there's a lot of work that I did around there, a lot more casual work, but it was incredible time. It was a great time for music at the time, a great time for black music specifically at the time. And a lot of my friends were very successful in a short space of time. So it felt amazing to work there. And then I think I realized that I didn't actually enjoy running a business. That wasn't my calling. I probably was a bit too young. So this is a very long answer to my question, by the way. But
keep going. It's great.
And then after, you know, after that point, it was just about, I wanted to work somewhere that just gave me a really good idea about the skill sets that I had acquired in my previous roles. And I could do it at a really good level within the business. So previously to that, I was probably more mid-level management rather than senior. And so after that, I did another stint at Betfair, but then I landed myself at City Football Group. So I did a few more other agencies. I was a publicist for a few of their agencies. I did one of WPP agencies. And then I landed at my City Football Group. And this is now 2015, so a significant amount of time have gone by since then. And City Football Group was fantastic because football was one of the greatest products in the world to market. But it's very, very different in terms of, it's not necessarily the cutting edge of marketing, but Man City had an incredible digital product, and they still do, one of the best in the industry, and largely because many of the older legacy teams had football channels that were on Sky. So you had MUTV and Liverpool TV or Red TV or whatever it is, Chelsea TV, and so it meant all of their best content had to go on those platforms as a primary way of speaking to their audiences, and they were trying to pay and get a subscription model with Sky, and they had those partnerships so they couldn't break away and do other things, whereas Man City were doing everything on YouTube. So they, you know, pioneered a lot of incredible content that was getting seen by many people's fans and reaching globally. And so, you know, they brought me in to lay out their branded content division, which was a fantastic opportunity to work with Nike, Etihad, NBC, and a whole bunch of other partners, but mainly Etihad. And in that time, you know, we built out and we worked in partnership with Big Balls, which is the organization that owns Copper 90, and we partnered on making this series called City Football Fans, which is going around the world on Etihad planes and finding Man City fans and telling their story and watching games with them. And it's really amazing, and I think we won a couple of awards for it as well, but it's just this really amazing, engaging piece of content that I was in charge of, and we started building out our rights with some of our other partners, and it really changed how, you know, the content was created around YouTube, and it started getting a lot more into the branded space other than the, you know, primary editorial space. And then shortly after that, I joined Samsung, which was looking after their content and services division. And that was, you know, my day one, I thought it's a really interesting story because I was actually brought in incorrectly in the wrong role. The role is content and services, and I was looking after content, and they understood the role to be content. And they got the brief from HQ, which is in South Korea. When I arrived on my first day, I think I did 3 days, and they were like, it's not content as like we're producing content. It's actually mobile content, so apps and platforms that we own and operate as an organization. And I was like, right, okay, slightly different to what I thought it was going to be. But I'm somebody that, you know, first and foremost, Samsung's a fantastic company. It's one of the best places I've worked. But, you know, I was a fan of the products anyway. So it's just a thing of just adjusting. And then this is where the use of my time in News UK with the e-commerce and monetizing platforms became really, really useful because I had, you know, a framework to apply to it. And so I was in charge of monetizing all of their digital real estate on their mobile, their tablets. And we would create partnerships with some of the biggest platforms in the world, anything from Netflix to Sky to, you know, preload apps and platforms and any, you know, we had our own app store. So any money generated from there was, again, a part of my remit. And I had this really amazing role that then really became sort of amplified by the launch of, you know, their voice technology, their AI, their AR technology, and, yeah, they had a health platform, and they really were stepping up in the game in terms of what their device could do. And so I was overseeing the functionality of those things and the monetization of those things, which is an incredible opportunity. And then after about 2.5 years of doing that, you know, between us, on the podcast between us, but the apps weren't necessarily performing to the standard that we needed. A lot of development was not as good as it should have been. And so it just created a lot of challenges. So, you know, I got headhunted by an agency in the WPP group to join them as a strategy lead. And that was my final role on this side of the fence. So in that time, I did launch Dope Black Dads, but I was a mere strategy lead for a WPP agency. And that was, you know, that was the making of all of my skill set coming into one. It was the first time I had a job where I was in flow.
Got you, yeah.
I was able to get everything I needed out of it without necessarily extending, but still being challenged in a healthy way.
Wow, it's an incredible story. Marvin, I'm developing a real habit of ambushing my own podcast by going off my own script really early. There's two things from what you just said I'd love to ask you about if I can. Like the first one, it's a good job we're recording this without audio, because otherwise people would have seen me staring at the mic with my mouth open. Like, I've never heard a story that you described at college, where all the teaching staff suddenly left. They said, "Really sorry, your college education is over." But the question I've got around that is, I think one of the very first things you said when I kind of kicked off saying, "How are you?" You spoke about, I think you used the words, "I'm naturally quite an optimistic person," or mm-hmm. kind of upbeat, and there's sort of a lot more kind of good than negative. Do you think that mindset or sort of behavioural trait was shaped in you as a result of sort of that experience or experiences like that, i.e. on the surface it looked terrible, but then you went to another college, which then opened up the door to go to university, which you wouldn't have done before? Or was you very sort of optimistic, positive, looking for the opportunities and everything beforehand?
I honestly think it stems from my upbringing. My mother is a resolute character anyway, and she's very entrepreneurial driven and didn't take any of the knocks that life gave her. She definitely, you know, would regenerate and do more amazing things afterwards. So I think there's a bit of right. that. But I also think, you know, I think growing up in Hackney in that time and at that age was a tough experience anyway. And I think, you know, many of us young people at that point was hitting floors in our life, the floor of our experience, and having terrible experience in different ways. And I think it just builds a character. Because I think right. once you decide and tell yourself that I don't care what anybody else thinks, or, you know, I'm going to have to make something of myself to have any chance of any form of happiness. Like, the stakes are very high in that socioeconomic environment. So for me, that not black backs didn't necessarily knock me back. It was just another thing to deal with. And you get used to dealing with things constantly. You actually get comfortable being in that place. And that's the thing that I've had to unravel later on in my life.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And the other thing I wanted to ask was, it sounds like from the very early part of your career, you had this experience where you kept moving jobs, just ticking off and being exposed to another aspect of marketing. I just wonder, was that an intentional strategy, or did it happen by accident? Because I think so often people can listen to stories, perhaps like yours or kind of other people, and they almost think that if I don't have a really structured plan to tick off all these different disciplines, experiences, then I'm never going to make it. So I'm curious, was it planned, or was it just how things unfolded for you?
It was an intention, but it also unfolded that way. So it wasn't necessarily planned, because I think the one thing I didn't have is a network or anybody to rely on to give me access to facilitate a plan. The one thing that I suppose I benefited from is that people of my generation, the kind of end of the millennial generation, people that are between 35 and maybe 40, they grew up in the internet age. And so, you know, my working career was constantly about digital advancement in marketing for the first time. So every industry I mentioned, see, ECRM, e-commerce, you know, mobile apps, platforms, social media, is all areas that brand partnerships in content and, you know, had never really been done. It's all been done for the first time in that moment. So probably the lack of awareness, and because of, you know, the place I held in sort of music entertainment, the friends are around, the, you know, the group of people that I went to, it just meant that I was involved in a lot of the things, again, a lot of breakthrough moments. I was just around it. So I was well placed to take, you know, what I was around and turn it into a service for businesses. So I think I was very lucky, but I also think I was very curious about those things. And I spent a lot of time practicing, educating myself on those things to get better at them. So it kind of just meshed together with, you know, divine intervention, but also curiosity.
Yeah, amazing. That makes sense. That's a real theme, actually, amongst the leaders I interview on the show, this curiosity, hunger for continually learning and exploring new stuff. Yeah. And can you tell us a little bit about Dope Black Dads, Marvin? I was kind of doing my research. I started looking into it and kind of your journey. I must say I was absolutely fascinated. So, yeah, just tell us kind of a little bit about it, sort of how it started, and I guess your hopes and aspirations for the organization.
Yeah, sure. So Dope Black Dads started probably at the beginning of my time at WPP, the agency, that my last role. And it was set up as a community group just for me. So it was like 25 or three dads that we had in a group on WhatsApp. We all were slightly highly functioning. We were all doing something in, you know, the arts or, you know, advertising or brand or something, and it was just about how to male parent basically from an intersection of the racial identity, and we just had lots of questions and none of us had really challenged some of the things that we were doing, and it allowed us to do that. And so we realized that that space was a rich space that we should, you know, invite others to, but also roll out to other intersections. So we have Dope Black Mums, Dope Black Men, Dope Black Women, Dope Black Queers, and Dope Black Disabled. And all those groups are run, designed by their own communities. And they, you know, come together and you know, reconcile their experiences, but also go out and challenge things that don't serve them and educate other people on their work. And so, you know, we've got all these community members now around the world based on, you know, the concept of being Dope Black. But for me, it was about, you know, how we pivoted from a group into a podcast. And the podcast was just a really good opportunity to extend the conversation out to a wider audience. And I think there were so many things that were happening that were really transformative and, you know, things that we'd never discussed as men or Black men before. It then allowed us to have that conversation. So, you know, putting it onto an hour-long platform and speaking unfiltered or uninterrupted was really, really powerful. And I think it caught on, and it was caught on by, you know, our partners, our friends, our, you know, our family, people that we knew, people who wanted to understand the Black male experience more. And so, you know, it went on to win some awards and get quite a lot of coverage over the time. But we've also been responsible for, you know, tackling injustices in society with corporations, with central and local government. And I think playing that role in the community, we kind of become the dads of the community. And we're you know, we're very much happy to stand there and speak up for the things that don't serve us or ultimately harm any of us, to be honest. It's not just about Black people. It's about, you know, we want to live in a better environment for our children.
That's incredible. The bit that really struck me when I was, I say, doing my research and reading the story was just how it went from, I think you said, a group of like 23, 25 people to support you, to growing into this organization operating in sort of several different countries with different sort of arms of the organization. Like, can you just tell us, and you touched on some of this already, but like, what was that like for you from a leadership kind of angle? What were some of the challenges effectively kind of leading kind of the Dope Black kind of groups as it grew and spread? What was that like?
It's funny because, as I said, I didn't probably get into senior leadership in my work career until probably about 5-6 years ago. So, you know, and also working in a team, most of my teams, because of the thing I was doing, was normally some reason underserved proposition in the business or new emerging proposition in the business. My teams were relatively small. And so leadership at that point became like having a great relationship with three people and them, you know, supporting them. You know, I think the biggest team I had was five. So it was one thing to be a leader and be accountable, but it's a whole nother thing outside of that context, because the intersection of professional and working relationship in Dope Black means that it's different. You know, you show up in people's lives in a different way and you're more accountable to people than you would be, you know, at work. You go home and if you do something wrong, it's just within the realm of your home or whatever. But a lot of those things can be seeped out. And so you have to be accountable in a different way and be the example for the community you're trying to serve. And it is a lot of pressure. And we're talking thousands of people around the world, because we now have groups in South Africa and the US as well as the UK, and more groups are launching. And so it does shine a massive light on the things that you find challenging. And I realized that my leadership model and my leadership style is, you know, I do need support in particular areas, because I'm very good at vision, strategy, monetization. I've done a certain level of therapy and emotional work, so I'm able to share my experience from that perspective. But some of the more empathetic and more patient traits needed to be done by other people. And that's the thing that I was able to discover in Dope Black Dads. And, you know, it's a completely different experience to what it would be in an actual company. It's very, very specific what we're doing. And I think it's put a massive mirror on where I'm strong and where I need support. And I've been able to, you know, address those things, which has been really, really good for me personally.
Yeah, that's incredible. And are there any sort of specific leadership tips, techniques, approaches that you've picked up along the way that you would share, I guess, for anyone in a leadership position? But I'm thinking, because it's a slightly different and interesting angle, but particularly for those who are leaders in any sort of social enterprise or in the charitable sector, because you touched there a few times on how it's different. Maybe it's more visible, more in focus. The impact can be greater. What would you share with those people?
Yeah, for me, I think the foundation of leadership, it comes in the reflection of yourself. If you don't understand who you are or why you behave in particular ways or the things that inspire you or trigger you or challenge you, then I think you always will struggle to be a leader because you have blind spots about what impact you put on the people that you're supposed to be leading. And you don't understand why you're strong or why you're good at what it is that you do. I think some people just believe they're good because they're just born amazing and the world shines out of them. But I think it comes down to a deeper psychological need as to how you're moved. So my view to anybody that's in leadership, you should be in some sort of reoccurring therapy if you can afford it or you can access it in a healthy way. I think it's the number one thing, because if you have that reflection, you can look at the points, you know, where you're strong and where you're not as strong and address those things. I think leadership has kind of been missold anyway as this, like, you are amazing already. And just by you being this way, everyone will follow you because what you think is, you know, the right thing, or it's the best thing, or it's a commoditizable thing because you may have had success in one area. Many, many people who are in leadership fail at a point, or fail when they believe that they should be succeeding. And if you're not aware of it and why that's happening, you know, soon you will see the bright spark that you had of the perspective that you've gathered in your experience is no longer of use to you and actually becomes a hindrance.
Yeah, that's amazing, Marvin. I'd love to delve into what you touched on there in terms of therapy. And clearly, I'm not diving into kind of what you explore in that therapy, although listening to you talk and getting to know you, I get a sense that you're a really sort of open, transparent and authentic guy. So I suspect you probably would be happy to share it. But kind of my question there, I think, is I suspect many people in business, many leaders in business, kind of when you mention the word therapy, they might either shut down, dismiss it, kind of think it's very unleadership like. Just talk to us a little bit, if you will, like when you say kind of being in therapy, what sort of thing are you talking about? Because I'm with you. I really kind of believe that, and I've been doing some more stuff myself personally in that area. But for those who might be a bit cynical or have some sort of preconceptions around that, just talk us through a little bit more what that looks like to you.
Yeah, I think in many ways, like, therapy is a hugely, as it's understood, is a hugely westernized concept, and talking therapy seems to be a central element of when people say therapy. But it's not the only therapeutic thing that you can do. So there are self-care regimes that you can do, and there's even things like baths that are fundamentally a healing process. It's like almost getting a giant warm hug with amazing accented smell and, you know, things around you. So it doesn't always have to center on talking therapy. I was referring to talking therapy specifically. But I think if you're not interested in that, there are many different things. So even Dope Black Dads as a community healing group is a form of therapy because it's group therapy. So we're all sharing authentically to each other. And you've got to find the version of that for yourself. And you don't have to necessarily do talking therapy. The value of talking therapy when you are working in a high pressure job or a leadership environment is that ultimately saying things out loud makes them real, whether for the best or for the worst. The things that you go through in your head that you think aren't necessarily real because nothing has been acted in reality when you're just thinking it. And so a lot of people believe that if they combine a convincing argument in their head, that they can then enact that and it will work perfectly because they went through all the permutations. The reality is nobody is in your head with you. And so when you speak it out loud to somebody who's of a sound mind that understands the structure and frameworks of communication and how people internalize things, then they can say things back to you and it becomes a reality because you can hear yourself back out loud through somebody else's lens, and it tests whether what it is that you think or you're experiencing is real or not. It's an incredible experience, and I think it's an important experience that everyone should be considering. It's not for everybody, but I think, you know, testing it out and having a session or two. Personally, I believe you should try and do 6 sessions, because I think 6 sessions is the first time you get, you know, a real perspective as to whether it works or not. So I think until then, you know, you can have so many different variations of a good and bad session, or what you may understand as a good and bad session, that it's very difficult to understand if it's working. But it takes about 6 sessions. It's about finding someone that you feel comfortable with and sharing. And the key thing to it is you have to be unfilteredly honest. It only works if you say the thing that you're desperately trying not to say to anybody else. And the great thing is that it's safe in that conversation, and it comes back at you with some sort of mirror, and you're able to be accountable and make changes that you need for the happiness in your life that you're probably ultimately chasing. You know, it's an assumption, but I believe you'll see most people want that.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing that and bringing that angle to the podcast, because it's not something that has shown up here before. And kind of, as I say, having just had a couple of sessions exploring that myself. I concur with everything you say and can see the benefits already. So thank you for that. Marvin, I'm conscious of your time and the listeners' time, so I'd love to finish up with a couple of slightly more quick-fire questions for 5 minutes, if that's okay.
Sure.
So you're clearly a busy guy, juggling your role as a father, your role at Beloved and Dope Black Dads, etc. How do you manage all of that? How do you manage your energy and stay sort of motivated?
Energy levels is I'm quite selfish and rigid with my time. So my day is on a very tight schedule. There's hours where I'm working. There's hours where I have time with my children. There's hours that I reflect on myself. If I feel like my day is not working in the way that I do, I do shut down and reschedule things. You know, I'm very intentional about preserving my own peace, because I think if I can't bring my best self to the things that I'm doing, you're not going to get a good experience anyway, and I won't feel good about it. So I try not to deplete, which is probably the best phrase that I can give you. I try not to deplete at any time on any level. I try to always make sure there's something there for me to recharge and protect myself from, you know, from negative experiences.
And does that involve a lot of sort of blocking time in your diary? How does that work for you on a very, very practical level? Because that's what people often want to know, right? What are the hacks? What are the techniques?
Yeah, so Monday and Friday, I don't start working until midday. So Monday is usually my admin day to prep for the week and brief my teams as to what they need to do or what the focuses are for the week. But then no one can put nothing in my diary until midday. And then on Friday, I finish at midday. And so that gives me a chance to wrap everything up for the week, but also reflect, and I spend time with my children in those times. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I do work a lot more intensely. So that's normally a 9 till, it could be anywhere between 7 and 8. But, you know, I feel like with that kind of condensation, it means the weekend is, you know, a lot longer for me. And I feel like I have an on and off switch. So that really, really helps me. So I block time out on my diary religiously that is unattainable to other people.
Well, love that. And what are the one or two books, Marvin, that have really had a big impact on you, or perhaps the one or two books that you frequently recommend the most to other people?
So there's two. There's one's The Ways of the Superior Man, which I think is a fantastic book. I think it helps men with their masculinity, and even things like not depleting yourself is one of the things that I learned from The Ways of the Superior Man, and using, you know, fuel. I think one of the chapters is about what women can do when women inspire you. How do you use that energy? And one was like how to channel it into your purpose, which is a really beautiful idea, and it can apply to other things as well. So Ways of Superior Man is a fantastic book. The other one is The Untethered Soul. Untethered Soul is a book about your inner voice, and it's a really powerful book for those people who are challenged with mental health or exhaustion or regularly think over things quite a lot. It's a great book to identify what your inner voice is and what it does for you. And it's probably one of the most referred to. Those books are by far the two most referred books to anyone that I know.
Amazing. And final question, Marvin, is there anything specific you're doing right now to successfully lead your team, lead your organizations at this time when just so many people are, I think, feeling tired and potentially finding it sort of tough to stay motivated? I think certainly in perhaps in the Northern Hemisphere, in UK, whilst we're in lockdown in the winter when the days are darker, sort of what are you doing from a leadership perspective there? Because I think that's something that we're all looking for the answers with, perhaps.
Yeah, sure. There's a couple of things that I did for my team. One is that I give them a significant amount of time off or downtime and time away from the thing that they're doing. I don't push anywhere near as hard as I probably would have, you know, in a different environment. I'm finding that people are naturally doing more anyway, but we need to not control it, but we need to guide that better. And so it's a healthy amount, because people are working themselves into destruction, I think, at this point, as a way of filling in the space and the feeling that they have. So, you know, telling people to down tools and bring in meditation. We have an online yoga class that we do at times. Now, I also sent my whole team a massage from a medium who's amazing. And that was a really nice experience. We do online meditations in the beginning of our meetings, and people really appreciate it. Some reflective time. But really, I just talk to them. I really humanize them. My whole team probably hear from me once or twice a week, and we try to just talk about the things that's going on for them, their challenges, how they can be supported. But just, you know, just checking in really on a personal level. For me as a, you know, CEO, I think both businesses combine of about 12 people full time, but 27, including all the volunteers and stuff for Dope Black. But, you know, it's a great group of people, and trying to collectivize them and give them positive experiences is the number one thing at this time. And we'll see how the year pans out. But I think that's something we're going to maintain going forward.
Amazing. You sound like a great guy to work for, Marvin. I'm really appreciative of you making time in your schedule to talk to me and the listeners today. So thank you so much for that. How can people get in touch or find out more about kind of you or kind of any of the organizations, Marvin?
Yeah, you can find me at Marvin Harrison on any of the platforms, M-A-R-V-Y-N Harrison, as in Harrison Ford. And then Dope Black Dads is the main platform, but we have Dope Black Men, Dope Black Mums, Dope Black Queers, Dope Black Women, and Dope Black Disabled. So find your intersection that most represents you, and you can follow them and find out more about the great work that's going on in our community.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. Have a great day for the rest of the day, whatever it is you're doing.
Thanks for having me.
There you have it, folks. My interview with Marvin Harrison, the MD at Beloved Agency and founder of Dope Black CIC. If you're enjoying the show, if you're getting great value from it, then please do take a moment to rate, review and subscribe, as it really does help us to keep bringing you more and more interviews with fantastic MDs, CEOs, and true subject matter experts. And before you go, do please also take a moment to click on the link in the show notes and check out my brand new online program, Personal Leadership Mastery. It's designed to help you get back on an even footing and lead you and your team to greater success. It will help you to work more productively, to enjoy more energy and drive in all areas of your life. It will also help you lead you and your team more consistently, to deliver better results, to live your life on purpose, saying yes and no to the things that truly matter and the things that are truly going to make a difference at work and out of work. And as a big thank you for listening to the podcast, I'm offering an exclusive Friends30 discount code, also in the show notes, that will take 30% off the retail price of my online mentoring program. So why not sign up now and get me as your virtual mentor in these challenging times? That's it for this episode, everyone. Stay safe, stay well, and lead on.